You all are the only case on our 10:30 oral submission docket, and I understand you've announced to our clerk the time you wish to argue, and if you all are ready to proceed, we'll get started. You ready? All right. Mr. Gibson.
Thank you. May it please the court. This was a continuous sexual abuse conviction, and as is the case with many of these crimes, there was an outcry statement that there was an outcry that was made by the victim. It was made to her mother, and there was a hearing on reliability as required.
As her stepmother?
Yes. I'm sorry. It was. That's right. Sorry, Your Honor. There was a hearing under 38072 having to do with reliability, which is required under the statute, that that the proponent of the outcry evidence, the state, show to the trial judge that the statement was reliable as to time, content, and circumstances. And our assertion in our brief is that there has to be kind of this gatekeeping function so that not just any old hearsay statement comes in. And like I said, it has to do with the time, content, and circumstances of the statement. In our brief, I tried to narrow the sort of factors that should be considered by this court. And I'm not a big fan of the Buckley factors, which comes from the Texarkana Court of Appeals, just partly because there's just so many of them, and so many of them don't really apply. But I agree with those courts that say, look, we ought to focus on the statement itself. And with regard to that, in this case, the stepmother initially didn't believe the girl at all. And to that end, we think that reliability should be measured at the time the statement is made, obviously. But it's only natural that there be sort of a subjective component to that reliability. And it's got to mean something that the person who actually hears the statement, or the person to whom the statement was made, didn't believe her. And that was based on her history, of course, and the fact that she considered the girl to be not truthful. Now, it's true that later she did go and talk to the girl's grandfather to corroborate one tiny part of the story, but I don't think that should necessarily put a lot of weight, let's say, into an analysis of the sort, just because I'm not sure where to draw that line. If the person to whom the statement is made is always expected to go and, you know, investigate it and be Lieutenant Columbo later to figure out, okay, is that right? I mean, are they going to go and investigate everything that she said? I think looking at it that way, we run into the danger of actually sort of trying to uncover whether the allegations themselves are truthful rather than just simply the reliability of the statement that was made at the time. So without sort of going in, well, let me just say that we think that there's got to be sort of this a subjective component to this, that if the person who hears the statement thinks that it's not believable, then that has to be considered.
And sounds I think like that you're saying you're supposed to consider that at the start because she didn't believe her at first, but then you're not supposed to consider the subjective component 15 minutes later when she decided maybe there is something to this.
Sure, but it would depend on, is it 15 minutes later? Do we wait until DNA results come back and she goes, oh, well, she must have been right? I mean, the point is, what did the person believe at the moment that the statement was made? Otherwise, because an outcry is an outcry, it's not what... it's not, what does my later looking into it,
does the outcry witness doesn't believe at the very moment that it was said to them that it's true, then the court shouldn't let the outcry statement in.
In this case, yes.
Okay.
Moving on to the search warrant in this case for DNA. And I'm going to, as far as the probable cause issue is concerned, I'm going to concentrate on just our code of criminal procedure and leave the Fourth Amendment argument to the brief. Basically, the code requires that probable cause must in fact exist when the warrant's issued. So that's got to mean that at the time the warrant's issued, that probable cause is there. And our position is that if there's no evidence to compare it to, then there's no probable cause at that time. And I don't want to confuse the issue. It's not that there's, of course, there's probable cause to believe that a crime's been committed. But at that moment, there's no probable cause to believe that the evidence which the warrant seeks to uncover would be evidence of that crime. And until then, his DNA is just his DNA. So at the time of the search, his cells didn't have any connection to a crime, and accordingly, the probable cause is lacking.
Do you have any cases to support that theory?
Absolutely not, Judge, except for the fact that, well, and again, not to get into the anticipatory search warrant issues that exist in the federal court, but I think that this has just never come up before, not in Texas anyway, and certainly not under 18.01, but that's our position. Now, as far as the execution of the warrant is concerned, this is interesting just because it's a little bit more clear cut, and strangely, it wasn't really discussed. It was objected to in court that the warrant specified. Let me just back up a little bit. The warrant specified that the appellant should be taken to an appropriate facility, and that his DNA be collected by a qualified person. And appellant objected on the basis that neither of those things existed. Well, the state failed to show that the DNA was collected in accordance with those commands. It wasn't shown that the officer that actually took it was qualified, and it wasn't shown that the DWI room at the police station was, quote-unquote, an appropriate facility. And so to that end, we think that it was an error to let in evidence, to fail to suppress the DNA evidence because of the fact that the execution of the warrant itself was faulty.
Is it your position that the lengthy testimony on the part of the officer about how the test was conducted reflects a flaw in the methodology used by the police officer in collecting the samples?
Well, on its face, not exactly. And as the state points out, we didn't provide the trial court with anything that would sort of undermine that. Now, I did make reference in the brief to the fact that wooden-handled swabs may not be the best choice, but, as far as I can tell, they're routine in Texas, and were certainly used in this case. But our point really is that whatever his testimony might have been about the methods that he used to actually collect the DNA, that it wasn't shown that he was a qualified person who could do it as per the warrant.
Qualified in the sense of his having experience in collecting bronchial samples over a course of time as a police officer in the U.S. Police Department?
I'm open to correction on this, but I'm not sure that he testified about his experience collecting DNA. And I could be wrong, but
I'm remembering that he testified about the use of the wooden swabs with the cotton on the end of it, and that they had individual sleeves to put them in, and that he did 20 or more brushes on each side, right side, left side of his mouth, and that he preserved those by putting them in the plastic sleeves, and that he had to leave them laying out for a while, and then ended up having to break the swabs, the wooden part of the swabs off a little bit because they were too long to fit in the box. All of that testimony you don't think was sufficient?
Sufficient to what, Your Honor? To show that he was...
the man's experience in the use of the... and the technique that he used to collect the DNA samples.
Well, I'm not sure that... I mean, he could have acquired that in knowledge in any... I mean, he could have looked it up on the internet while he was doing it. I don't know. I mean, I don't... But I would not go so far as to say that that by itself, if that were true, and we don't know because there's really no testimony about it, that would make him qualified as far as the magistrate who issued the warrant was concerned. Now, whether it was done in accordance with generally accepted practices, and again, we really don't know, to me would be a different question from whether he's qualified or not.
Okay, well, let me get clear in my mind. The timing of when the defendant was taken in custody, taken to the police station, given the bronchial swab test, was all after the outcry, wasn't it?
Yes.
So there was already some evidence of his involvement in what was ultimately the crime charged when he was given those bronchial swab tests.
Are we going back to the first thing?
I'm just saying, you said that there was no, at the time the tests were given, there was no other evidence connecting him to the crime.
No, I'm sorry. I was talking about when the warrant was issued. But that obviously had to have been after the outcry as well.
And the warrant was issued. Yeah, the warrant was issued after the outcry, and the test was done after the outcry.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Finally, and I won't spend much time on this, but the statements made for purposes of diagnosis. Dr. Reeder testified to statements that were made by the victim in this case to her, and the court let them in on the basis that they were pertinent to diagnosis. Our position is that there was no real evidence, and this was the sort of clear, direct objection, there was no real evidence that the victim understood, or the patient, if you will, understood that she was making these statements for purposes of diagnosis. And to that end, trial counsel relied on Taylor versus State that we've cited in our brief. And that's, again, that has to be a component of an analysis under this. And the fact that Dr. Reeder understood why she was asking the questions and that it was for purposes of diagnosis, we believe it is not enough under that hearsay exception to justify its admission. Thank you very much.
May it please the court, Stephen Condor on behalf of the state in this case. I'm going to concentrate my argument on the first two issues, the outcry and the search warrant issues. On the outcry witness testimony, I think the focus to remember is that the issue is whether it's reliable. And the test that we've been given from the Court of Criminal Appeals is that it must be based on the time, content, and circumstances of the outcry. And yes, I think that the Buckley standards that were taken in by the court in Gonzales are something for us to look at, but as they've said and made clear that we don't have to hit every standard. But if you actually look at what MC told her stepmother, it seems like that a lot of those standards were met, that this was a spontaneous outcry, that there was nothing, no evidence that there was some sort of manipulation, that she was able to provide more descriptions when at question, that she provided a very clear and unambiguous act of sexual abuse, and she attempted to provide a corroborating eyewitnesses to show that there was some evidence the defendant had the opportunity to commit it. Now, I think what the defense is trying to say is that reliability must be based solely on the initial take of the listener, and I just don't think that that's what the standards called for, and there's no case law that seems to suggest that because that makes no sense. The first time anybody might hear a statement, so-and-so abused, abuse me. Your first might be, you might be initial. I think initial disbelief is actually a natural reaction. You're like, what? Because it's not something that comes up in a normal conversation. So I think it's, I think to just solely focus on the initial reaction of the outcry is not what this is about. It's about, was the information that came from the child to the adult, was that reliable information? And I think what the stepmother did in this case was actually something not to be criticized, but to be applauded. She sat and she listened to this child and she thought about it and she realized what this child is saying to me is making sense. She didn't automatically disbelieve it, or she didn't automatically believe it. She thought about it. And I think that's the whole point of outcry is was this a credible statement? Was this a reliable statement? And then the fact that the listener had to think about it should not implicate whether or not it's reliable. Regarding the search warrant, again, this is I think the defense does make it clear this is kind of an area that really has not been written about by the courts in Texas. But I think the key thing to remember with probable cause is that do the facts and circumstances support the conclusion that a fair probability that exists that contraband or evidence of a crime is specified location? Now, I think if you look at the search warrant, I mean, I think we're all in agreement. It states out a particular offense, the continuous sexual abuse. It states out a particular purpose, seizing this evidence. But I think what's really shows is a fair probability, and it makes clear in the search warrant affidavit and the fact that this was a very recent sexual assault. This young girl had said the last occurred within that day, so which made the doctor at the clinic do a more acute exam, and so it made it much more likely that there was going to be something that could be obtained from that. So the fact that, like, they hadn't yet done the initial lab testing, there's no case law out there that says that you have to do some initial lab testing and find that there is some result that they can get up there before you have your reference sample to compare it to. That just seems like that's beyond what is required of a search warrant. So it's the state's belief that the police acted properly. There was probable cause for them to at least collect his reference sample to be compared to what they obtained from the search warrant affidavit. Unless the court has any questions, the state would rely on its brief for the other two points of error.
Thank you, Mr. Conder.
Just briefly, Your Honors, the issue is reliability, and I agree that I agree with quite a lot of what he says. There's no evidence of manipulation. And oftentimes the initial take of the listener will be disbelief. I think what makes this slightly different from a sort of routine outcry was that, and I didn't really mention this before, but let me emphasize it now, that MC's credibility was at issue when her stepmother heard this statement, and because of her history of lying and manipulation generally, although maybe not in this particular case, she was inclined not to believe her. And I don't want to overstate that. Well, of course, in most cases, if a young person came up and made these sorts of allegations to their stepmother, whatever, of course the initial reaction is going to be, I don't believe it. But in this case, there was actually, she stated reasons why she didn't believe it, and it was clear from her testimony that she didn't. Now, I do realize too that she did sort of ferret out the corroboration from the grandfather. But I will take this opportunity to point out that it's fairly weak corroboration. He was she was able to corroborate that the grandfather and the appellant went to the bathroom at the same time, which, given the circumstances of the statement and her history of credibility, I'm just not sure it really proves that much, or at least it doesn't, to me, it doesn't seem to make the statement more reliable. And if there's nothing else, thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for your argument today. Your case is submitted, and we will be adjourned.
The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.